The Secret Fire Podcast and the Great Commission Transmission Network is made possible by the support of listeners like you.
To learn more and to partner with us, visit us at gctnetwork.com/donate.
Gandalf, my old friend, this will be a night to remember.
Hail and well met. This is Michael from the Secret Fire Podcast. Brendan, Mike, and I took a break from our normal adventures through the Lord of the Rings this week in order to celebrate the Thanksgiving holiday here in the States. And that made for the perfect opportunity to once again open up the vaults at the old Middle-earth network, brush aside Shelob's webs, and bring you yet another fantastic interview. And this one is sure to please fans of the Chronicles of Narnia. We had the absolute honor of spending time in wonderful conversation with the stepson of C.S. Lewis, Mr. Douglas Gresham. Mr. Gresham is an American-British stage and voice actor, biographer, film producer, all three of the Narnia films, in fact, and much more. Douglas and his brother David were adopted by C.S. Lewis when he married their mother, Joy Davidman, and it was to the two brothers that C.S. Lewis dedicated The Horse and His Boy. I believe that this interview originally aired on Middle Earth Network Radio in October of 2011. In it, you'll hear myself, Mark Ostley, John D. Bartolo of the Lonely Mountain Band, Arwen Kester of Middle Earth News, and guest co-host Paul Martin of NarniaFans.com. Let's get right into it. We begin with a question from a member of the listening audience by the name of Tyler. And if memory serves, I believe that it was Tyler Michael Johnson who you heard on our previous Secret Fire podcast special, an interview with Tolkien scholar Tom Shippey. The question to Douglas Gresham: can you share any anecdotes about C.S. Lewis, J.R.R. Tolkien, and the Inklings?
Well, how long do we have?
We have all day.
Well, by the way, I'm presuming that he's referring to anecdotes rather than antidotes.
Thank you. Actually, he did in parentheses put anecdotes on behalf of Mark.
So. He did.
Sneaky.
Well, you know, there's so many things one could talk about Jack when I was growing up with him. He was a remarkable man, and we had some remarkable times together, of course. But most of this, of course, is covered in my book, Lent and Lands. But the sort of occasion, there are several of them, but the sort of occasion that stands out most in my mind to this day is the occasion when they had bought me, my mother and Jack had bought me a, Jack, by the way, was C.S. Lewis's nickname. They bought me a little kayak, a canvas-covered, wooden-framed boat, with which I paddled around the lake behind the kilns with great enthusiasm. And it was November, late November, and very cold. There wasn't any ice on the lake, but it was getting close to that. Jack, my mother, came walking up beside the lake as I was paddling around furiously. And Jack called me to the shore and asked me if I would ferry him across the lake. Now, Jack didn't have the best sense of balance in the world, but he braved the idea of getting into this very, very fragile little craft and allowing me to paddle him around the lake and showing him all the hidden places in the willow trees and things, and then eventually delivered him to the other side of the lake quite safely, thank God. But he braved the risk of being ducked in icy water simply because he knew it would give a small boy a great deal of pleasure to be honored with the task of ferrying him across the lake. And that sort of charitable gesture stands out as an epitome of Jack's character and personality. He was always trying to make people feel more important than they probably really were. He always sort of took a back seat and let other people have center stage and so forth. He was a wonderful guy. I mean, we could talk about this kind of thing all day at your end, but all night at my end, because I'm on the other side of the world, remember. But he was a fascinating man in so many ways, and it was a great time in my life, despite the fact that the sword of Damocles of my mother's impending death hung over our heads all the time. It was a time of great joy and great delight, as well as a time of great fear and great sorrow. But it was Jack that made it delightful and exciting, and it was almost like living in a fantasy world in a sense, because although we knew that there was a doom approaching, we sort of shoved it to one side and got on with having fun a lot of the time, walking up in the wood behind the kilns, expecting to see a fawn or a centaur trot out from behind the trees at any moment, as if we thought Narnia really was a live, living place and we were there. it was a sort of game we used to play. It was great fun.
That's a wonderful tale. That is beautiful. Thank you. You know, and to kind of take it in a different direction here, right away, you mentioned that you're on the other side of the world.
Well, right now I'm sitting in my office overlooking the lights of the port of Birzebuja on the island of Malta.
Wow. That's
right in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea.
And what are you doing in Malta?
What am I doing? I live here.
Aside from just living there.
Well, there's a sign on my office door which reads, outside of this office, there is a life to be led. Regrettably, I spend most of my time inside the office. But no, I do most of my work from here. This is where I live. This is where I do most of my work. The email answering that I go through every day and all of that sort of thing is all done here. But, you know, Malta's a lovely place to live. It's an interesting island. It has an enormous history. The history stretches back almost to the dawn of man, I guess. Every single Mediterranean nation has at one stage or another seems to have conquered Malta and then been thrown out again later. And there are great fortresses and ancient buildings and so forth. We have buildings that go back about 30,000 years, according to the archaeologists here in Malta. The remains of them, I mean. It's a place steeped in history and fascinating, and it's an interesting place to live.
And so what made you choose Malta as your home?
Well, I was running my wife and I were running a Christian psychotherapy and counseling ministry in Ireland. And we did that for about 13 or 14 years. And toward the end of that time, I was getting more and more heavily involved in working with the C.S. Lewis Company as the creative and artistic director. And then also, of course, getting involved in making the Narnia movies. So a lot of my time was spent overseas and rushing about all over the place and working very hard. And my wife started to shoulder more and more of the responsibilities of the ministry, which was a sort of 7 day a week, 24 hours a day ministry in some ways. And it was becoming far too much for her. And the Lord slowly made it very evident to both of us that it was time to wind it down and move on. At the same time, many years earlier, I had restored a steel yacht in Australia, which we'd sailed the East Australian coasts for some years before we left and came to Ireland. And my sons were looking after her in Sydney, but they all gradually left and went other ways. And so it was senseless. We had this boat sitting on Sydney Harbour with no one using it. So I decided to get a friend of mine to sail it over, and he sailed it over to Portside, and I joined the crew, and we brought it up to Malta. And I was hoping that we would cruise the Mediterranean. The reason I brought it to Malta was it's right bang in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea, more or less. So everywhere was within a couple of days of sailing from Malta. But in the end, I was so busy, I never got time to use the boat other than to fly over and have a quick holiday and fly back. So eventually we sold that boat and did the same thing with another one. But in the interim, we got to know quite a lot of Maltese people, and we got to like the architecture, the climate, the food, just about everything about Malta in many ways. And so when the Lord made it plain it was time to wind down the ministry, and we thought, well, where will we go? And we decided that having been in Ireland for 13 years and only had 3 summers, it would make good sense to go somewhere where the sun shines occasionally, because it doesn't do that very often in Ireland. Malta seemed like the obvious place, which is why we've now been here for 5 years.
You guys spent a lot of time in Australia. Your wife was from Australia. Is that correct?
Yes and no. My wife was actually born in Masasi in Tanganyika, as it was then, Tanzania, as it is today. And she lived the first 5 years of her life there. But after the end of the Second World War, her parents decided to emigrate to Australia or somewhere. They sort of just picked it by latitude, I think. And Tasmania looked like an interesting place, so they emigrated to Tasmania. So Mary was, although born in Africa, was brought up in Tasmania. And then when she became a nurse and wanted to branch out a bit, she came over to England on a working holiday, and we met. Actually, she stepped down off a train at Taunton Railway Station, and I decided to marry her as she stepped down off the train. But that's a long story.
More romance.
That also is in my book. But eventually, I mean, it cost me every cent I had in the world. It took me 3.5 years, but I decided I eventually managed to persuade her that this was a good idea. We went back after marrying. We went back to Australia and spent 26 years there, raised our children there. Almost, except the youngest, who eventually grew up in Ireland and is still there to this day. And all my 3 sons who grew up in Australia have returned to Australia from their various sojourns at various different places around the world. And we have 10 grandchildren out there too. So we still have sort of very, very tight connections with Australia. And it's emotionally, Tasmania is my sort of spiritual home. The only place in the world, although I've lived all over the planet, Tasmania is the only place in the world where I sometimes at night wake up and just long to be. It's the only place I feel homesick for. So maybe one day I'll retire and return to Tassie.
Paul mentioned that you have some kind of upcoming announcement. but it was up to you when you were going to talk about it. Do you feel free to talk about that? You can blame Paul for spilling the beans.
I'm not quite sure what he's talking about, actually.
Paul, take over.
Paul, let me know what you're on about.
You told me about a project that was going on that would be some type of a live event.
Oh, the stage production.
Bingo.
I don't think we can actually talk too much about that yet because it's not my sort of material to reveal. But just suffice it to say that we are working on the very early beginnings of a possible very large stage production of Lion Witch.
Oh,
that's all I can really tell you at the moment.
That's more than enough
That's
there.
A good teaser.
Yeah, that's a very good, teaser.
Did we just get the scoop on a new announcement?
I suppose there will eventually be an announcement by somebody, if it happens. But of course, these things are always very iffy at the very early stages. So these things, when we say that, you know, we're working on something, I mean, I've got half a dozen ideas I'm working on.
Yeah.
But I just have no idea whether any of them are going to come about or not yet. So we just have to wait and see. And pray lots.
Indeed. And I understand, too, when Michael and I were chatting with you earlier in the week to do the sound test, one of the things that I'd come across in my research and we had chatted about was that I think one of the articles that I had read was that as your children were growing up, they were so used to you. All that you talked about at the time was how you could bring Narnia to the big screen and how it was a very driving force to do that. And you finally were able to bring it to the big screen. And I think the quote that I read was that when the first time you saw Narnia on film on the big screen like that, it brought you to tears practically.
Well, the first time I sat down and saw the whole of the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe movie for the first time in one piece, yes, it did. It brought me to tears because it was the culmination of something I've been working very hard on for a very long time. But the more interesting sidelight to this was my kids came to visit the sets while we were shooting it. Particularly my second son, Tim, and his family. He had three children. And at that time, his eldest son was quite small, and he had a baby as well, Georgie. And they came to the set, and Tim suddenly Jack was riding on his shoulders. It was sort of a funny sidelight again. He was walking into the set of the White Witch's battle camp. And the cast and so forth hadn't arrived yet, but the crew had got all the sets and everything prepared and the sort of racks of ugly-looking weapons and campfires burning, and the guys with the smoke generators had just fired up, and this evil mist was sort of seeping through this place. And young Jack, who must have been about four at the time, toddled around. He was on his father's shoulders. He looked around at me, and he looked around at what he was seeing around him, and he said to his father, "Daddy, this place is evil." And I knew we'd got it right, just instantly. But a short while later, Dig, that's Tim's nickname, put Jack down and suddenly walked off into the bush by himself. I thought, that's odd. What's the matter with Tim? And so I went after him. I said, "Dig, what's the matter, son? You know, you're upset about something." And he turned to me and said, "Daddles," which is my nickname in the family, "Daddles, all my life, you know, I've been hearing about you, you know, talking and dreaming about trying to make Narnia come to life in the movies. And now, all of a sudden, I'm standing in the middle of it. And it's just all become real to me. It's such a shock." And I thought, well, you know, that's really, really rather wonderful to hear. And my daughter, Lucinda, who actually came at a different time to Tim and joined us at Aslan's battle camp, had the same reaction. It just moved her enormously to suddenly be in the middle of real Narnia. She said, ever since she was a tiny little girl, hearing me talking about Narnia and reading her the books and so on, she had always felt, knew at the back of her mind that somewhere Narnia was real or was going to be real.
Oh, wow.
And then all of a sudden she was standing in Aslan's battle camp. And I knew as soon as those reactions happened that we had got things right in that movie.
So now I'm interested to know, when was the first time that you ever laid eyes on the Chronicles of Narnia?
Now, that would be about 1950 or 51 in upstate New York, near Strasbourg, where my mother brought the books to read to us and for us to learn to read on.
What was your impression?
Oh, I was fascinated, absolutely. How could one help being fascinated by Narnia? And I've always wanted to live there, and Tasmania is the closest I've ever got. I mean, weird things pop out of the bush in Tasmania too, but unfortunately not fauns or satyrs or temples. So I must tell you, when we finished the movie and we had released, it was in the early stages of the movies being out, Lion Witch, that was. I was talking at a university somewhere in America, which shall, for obvious reasons, remain utterly nameless. And a very pretty blonde lady approached me after the sort of preview of the movie and said, "I have to ask you, are those centaurs real?" So I said, well, you know, the weirdest thing, we flew by helicopter across the deep mountains of the southern island of New Zealand, and we found suddenly this little tiny valley in the middle of these tall mountains. There were no roads in. And I said, we landed the helicopter, and then, sure enough, coming out of the bush, you know, she was following all this avid interest. So it wasn't until I got halfway through describing our meeting with the Centaur family that we discovered there that she suddenly woke up to the fact that I was teasing her. So obviously our guys got the Centaurs pretty right, I think.
I want to take this opportunity to remind all the listeners that you are tuned in to Middle Earth Network Radio with our very special guest, Douglas Gresham, who, of course, is the stepson of the late, great C.S. Lewis. We want to say hello to all of our listeners in the United States, the United Kingdom, Germany, Poland, Brazil, Hong Kong, Canada, Malta, I wonder who that is, the Philippines, Romania, and all around the world right now. And John DiBartolo is in the Bird and Baby on the Landreval server in Lotro. So if you are listening and playing right now on the Landreval server, you can interact with John in the virtual rabbit room. Isn't that right, John?
That is correct, sir. Standing next to Jack Lewisdown and some of the other Hobbit Inklings here, waiting for friends to say hello.
Yes, yes. And we have a lot of people in the chat room right now, and the questions are coming in fast and furious. Arwen, what's the next question that we need to address?
Trina sent in a question. Which of C.S. Lewis's books is your favorite and or most influential in your life?
It's, you know, that's a really difficult question to answer, and I get it quite often. And the reason it's difficult is because Jack wrote in so many different genres. If you took science fiction, the most influential and most my favorite of those three books would be Perelandra. If you want to look at the children's fantasy area, of course, we're looking at the Narnian Chronicles. And I suppose my favorite book in that series would have to be whichever one I'm reading when someone asks me the question. So right now it's Silverchair. Most influential, again, you can go further, of course, in his Christian apologetics. I think Mere Christianity and the Great Divorce top them for me, but they're all fabulous books. Screwtape Letters is one of my very favorite of all of his books, and of course that doesn't fall into any particular genre category at all. It's a one-off. But I guess if I had to pick one book out of all Jack's works of fiction particularly as my favorite, it would have to be Till We Have Faces.
Ah, yes. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I think
that is
now becoming recognized by Lewis scholars and literature scholars around the world as being the greatest work of fiction Jack ever wrote. And I still read it just about every year.
Yeah, I would have to say that too. Till We Have Faces is probably one of his most profound, and seriously, I think just out of that whole realm of literature, probably one of the best books that came out of that century. I really think that it was probably one of his greatest works.
I agree completely. It's an extraordinary book in the depths and levels of meaning it has in it, and things that it reveals. I mean, I probably had read it about 12 times before I really started to understand it.
Yeah.
And I'm still finding new levels in it as I read it over and over again.
No, that's exactly right. We do have a question, and it's one that I would like to ask too, but it comes from Robert out in the audience. But have you found it difficult to find your own identity having such a well-known and loved stepfather and mother?
Well, interestingly enough, no. And I think the reason for that is, for some reason, the Lord decided to create with me with the most enormous ego I've ever encountered.
Oh.
Please excuse me for saying this, but I spent many years as a professional broadcaster, which translates into real English as professional conceitist. We were paid to sell ourselves to our audience, a bit like politicians in a sense, I suppose. Except I think broadcasters are probably more honest in most cases. But I don't really think I've had any problems discovering my own identity. And I think, again, one of the reasons for that is if you have 5 children and 10 grandchildren, they soon show you who you are pretty clearly.
From Lou out in the audience, most of us Narnia fans know that Walden's contract with the series has expired, but many of us are curious for more information. And he says, if possible, and if not, we understand. So.
Well, again, I think if you're aware that Walden's contract with the company has expired, that's true. And that leaves us in a situation where, for a variety of different reasons, we cannot immediately produce another Narnian Chronicle movie. But it is my hope that the Lord will spare me and keep me fit and healthy enough so that in 3 or 4 years' time we can start production on the next one. And by that time, incidentally, we will have a whole nother generation. Oh, God, I said a whole nother. That's terrible. Lord, why did you allow me to do that? I have been campaigning against that expression for years. However, another whole story, but whatever I was saying, we will, I hope, be able to start production and find another budget. Of course, it's possible that by then the world's economic struggles may have leveled out a little bit, and we may be on the uprise again economically, globally, in which case finding a budget for another Narnia movie probably won't be terribly difficult. But we'll have to wait and see. It's in the Lord's hands, and he knows what he's doing better than we do. So it's up to him to do what he wants done.
Well said. And I'm getting in our Skype chat and in other texts, Paul is being rather quiet, so we're supposed to give him some time to talk as well.
I didn't know Paul talked a great deal.
Yes.
Oh. You're on, Paul. We want to hear more from you, and maybe you can recite or briefly tell about Mr. Gresham's involvement with your matters of the heart.
Go for it, Paul. Go for it.
Nice. Go for it. This story deserves to be told anyway. So.
All right. Well, a couple years ago, I had an idea to propose to my then girlfriend on the set of The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, which was filming was coming up. So I contacted Doug Gresham.
Hey, Paul, before you go on,
yes.
I have all of those emails right here in my computer, so I can bring them up and check what you're
doing. Awesome. Yeah, so it was months before. Courtney had no idea that any of this was going on. And so I just said I'd like to...
Paul, let me take you back a bit,
yes.
Because I think you're going too fast.
Okay.
What first happened was I got this email from Paul saying that he would love to have a set visit to come and see the sets of Dawn Treader. So I said, of course, we make you very welcome. And then he did this very sneakily. And then he emailed and said, well, actually, what I'd really like to do is bring my girlfriend with me to the sets. And I said, well, that's fine. We can find room to put two of you on the set. It won't be a problem. And then he emailed again and said, well, actually, if it's at all possible, might it just possibly be okay if I proposed to my girlfriend on the set of the film trailer? So I wrote back and I said, well, why don't we do it properly and put you on the deck of the ship itself? And Paul can take it from there.
So. Yes. So,
I'm just going to interject that actually I'm this is very curious hearing two sides of this, because Paul gave you absolutely no credit whatsoever,
and Mr. Gresham tells the story a whole lot better.
Absolutely untrue.
No, Paul, we recorded this this interview last Tuesday. So.
Yes, indeed. But Courtney has no idea. So we planned this trip to go to Australia to visit the set, and that week. Beforehand, I not only we got the plane tickets, but then I also went out and found a ring for her, and I booked a hotel room, which is the only open hotel room in the whole city that they were filming in. So that made it very difficult. So then we flew down there and got to the set on Monday, and everybody was just kind of walking around, and we were talking to people. And Doug, you took Courtney aside to chat with her I went off with a bunch of the crew, and we planned out how it was going to happen. So then they broke for lunch, and everybody got off of the Dawn Treader, and then we climbed up onto the Dawn Treader, and we're taking a tour of the boat, and Shane Rangy came and everything along with us. So we went up by the helm, where everybody kind of gave me the nod. So I turned to Courtney, and I said, hey, Courtney. And she's like, what, huh? Courtney, what? Courtney. And then she finally looked at me, and then I said, our first date was to see The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I got down on one knee and pulled the ring out of my pocket and said, will you marry me? And she shouted at the top of her lungs, yes! And then we hugged, and everything was just
beautiful.
Really fast after that. We got pictures taken, and then Doug announced it to the cast at lunch. And everybody had known about it beforehand, though. It was in the call sheet from the week before, which was really funny.
Must be the only proposal that was ever actually incorporated in a complete movie shoot.
Indeed.
Everybody knew what was going on. It was all strategically planned. Everyone had to get off the boat by a certain time and so on.
Yeah.
The only thing we were all terrified of course, was if Courtney had said no. We didn't know what we'd do.
that was actually our comment, too, yeah.
No pressure.
Because Michael Apted came up to me afterwards and goes, we were all hoping she'd say yes.
We were, too.
Oh, yeah.
Another question, and I think this one is from, let me get this correct here, it's from Lou. What about the space trilogy? Any plans in the future or any foreseeable plans to have that made into a movie as well?
Well, I would absolutely love to film the space trilogy. The problem will be, as always, finding someone with deep pockets and a large budget, because they will not be inexpensive movies to make. I think they would take the world by storm, because A, there's a wonderful story to start with, but secondly, of course, they have very important messages to impart. And thirdly, scenically, if we do it right, they would be stunningly beautiful to watch. Yeah, I'd love to make those films. If someone out there who's listening has got lots and lots of money and wants to get embroiled and embark on this interesting exercise of making movies, please get in touch.
We do want to ask, too, in terms of just what you're doing now and what your plans for the future are now, with both family, if we can ask, and professionally.
Well, family's pretty simple. I mean, we have, as I said, we've got 3 sons and 10 grandchildren in Australia. I have a daughter who's currently living in Florence, who's a custom jeweler, which means that if you have something you particularly want that you can't find, you go to her and describe it. And as you talk, she draws pictures of what you're describing until she gets it absolutely right. And then she goes away and makes it for you. I mean, she made the commemorative jewelry for all 3 of the Narnia. Well, she made the second 2, actually. She designed it, and a jeweler actually messed up the first one. But so we got Lucinda to make the next one. She made the commemorative jewelry for Prince Caspian and for Dawn Treader, which is a gesture of mine that I like to give little bits of mementos, as it were, to the stars of the movie and the principal production's crew and so on. But she's done some wonderful work for people in Hollywood, friends of mine and so forth. And yeah, we're very proud of her. Then we have another daughter. Our youngest daughter grew up in Ireland, Melody, and she is still in Ireland. She has a couple of degrees from Trinity College in Dublin, but hasn't the faintest idea what she wants to do with her life. I think she's 25 now. And so she's at the moment working in a pub waiting for inspiration to strike her about what to do next with her life. Meanwhile, my eldest son, James, became an airline captain in the States. He was flying for Delta for a while, but eventually got very sick of sort of infighting and politics of the whole business, though he loved the flying. So he resigned that and went back to Australia and bought a beef farm, where he now raises beef cattle. And my second son, Tim, has his own medical diagnostics machinery company, sales company, distribution company. And my third son, Dominic, James has 2 sons. Tim has 2 boys and a little girl. And my third son, Dominic, is an architect in Brisbane, and he has 5 children. He has 4 boys and... four girls, and suddenly a boy popped up. So it was kind of interesting, because when the boy was born, he had picked out a girl's name, fairly obviously enough, after 4 girls, had no idea what to call a boy. So for about 3 or 4 weeks, poor little fellow was completely nameless, but he actually wound up calling him Caspian.
Oh, wow.
Wonderful. Okay.
So we have a Prince Caspian in the family, which is really cool.
And proper.
So, nice. But as far as my plans are concerned, I'm just going to wait until the Lord moves me into the next thing. I mean, I cheat. I don't make plans for my own life, because I'm not qualified to govern it anyway. It took me a very long time to realize that, but I did in the end. So it's up to Jesus to decide what I do next. And at the moment, I'm just doing my usual thing of answering emails from all over the planet. A lot of them are still, I mean, after 13 years in counseling and ministry, psychotherapy ministry, you sort of have a lot of patients who will be patients for life, in a sense, in that they have become good friends through the therapy and still consult you occasionally when something goes pear-shaped for them. So I do a lot of that still. And a lot of business-oriented, ministry-oriented things come through on the internet these days and not by email, which has made life a lot more easy, but also in some ways a lot more busy. So I just sit here in Malta, enjoying the weather, and do my normal work. But it's up to the Lord to decide the next great leap forward, as it were, or perhaps leap sideways. You never know with him.
Let me sneak in a quick question here. I'm going to be selfish, and I'm going to ask my own question.
Yeah, please do.
The first movie, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the first time that you watched it, the completed project, being able to hear all the sound and all the visual in all its glory, what was your first reaction to seeing and hearing Aslan?
I think Aslan came across very well in the first movie, although Liam's voice wasn't sort of changed at all in that movie. We just let Liam do it his own way, and he was
He was good, but I think he was better in the following movies when his voice was sort of computerized a bit and deepened and enriched and so on.
Right.
I don't think I had a particular reaction to Aslan because the whole movie had hit me so hard. I mean, I started to cry at about the time when the kids got to the professor's house.
Yes.
And it suddenly was the real Lion, Witch, the Wardrobe coming out of the screen. I'd seen bits and pieces right through all in piecemeal.
So I can gather then that that you were of the mind seeing the entire package that it moved you equally across the board.
Yes, it did. It's interesting because it wasn't until quite a few viewings of it later that I began to sort of see where we'd made mistakes. I mean, I'm one of those weird people who's never really happy, never completely satisfied with stuff I've done. And so after about 4 or 5 viewings of the movie, I started to say, oh, I wish we'd just cut that a little bit sooner or a little bit later or whatever, you know, to myself. But the impact of it first up was huge. And I think many people throughout the world felt the same reaction, not because they were involved in it as I was and as close to it as I've been all my life, but simply because it is such a powerful film. But then that's true of the other two as well. They have their own power, each of those movies. And I know that people who have seen The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, several people have told me they have gone back to see it again in order to achieve again that sort of huge build-up to the last scenes. And it's the ending of that movie is so superb. It's jaw-droppingly good. And that's something I'm very, 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 very proud of in that movie.
I would say that's my favorite scene from all of the movies, that final scene of the Dawn Treader.
It's pretty amazing, yeah. But not the final scene, the penultimate scene.
Right,
just before
correct.
They go through the wave. And funnily enough, we shot that first. That was very close, if not first, very close to the beginning of the filming.
I do have a question, another question from Thomas, who was the person that I forgot his name last time. But did you ever meet Tolkien?
Oh, yes, of course. I mean, he was one of my stepfather's very best friends. I was never old enough to get to know him really thoroughly because he was a sort of, you know, two generations ahead of me. But what I did see of him, I liked enormously. I owe him a great debt of gratitude to this day, because when Jack was in hospital dying, no one had actually told me that Jack was dying. They told me he was ill, and I knew that, of course. I went to visit him. I think the last time I saw him was at the hospital when he was very ill. And as I came out of the hospital to return home to the kilns, I met Tolkien on his way in, and he said to me, I don't know if you'll remember who I am. I said, well, of course I remember who you are, you know, because we didn't see him that frequently. But he said, look, I'm Professor Tolkien. I just want to let you know that should anything untoward happen to Jack, and if you need somewhere to live, you're absolutely welcome to come and live with me. And I thought that was astonishing. I did have somewhere to go. As it happens, I had a guardian who was going to take me and give me a home and didn't need another house or to live in. But just imagine what my life might have been like had I wound up the business mind of Tolkien as well as the Lewis one. That would have been too much to take, I think.
Yeah, a bit of the best of both worlds. But we have about 15 minutes left, and I want Arwen to get to the rest of these questions. Arwen, we've got a lot of questions. I don't know if we're going to be able to get to them all from the audience.
We do. Let's see. A question came in from Lou. Are you anticipating the new movie about Lewis's life, C.S. Lewis, the movie? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I wouldn't like to say too much about it because I'm one of the people working on it, which means, of course, I'm somewhat biased. I would like to see the people producing this movie and the screenwriters and everybody concerned with it. The problem we face is that Jack's life, from the time he arrived on this planet to the time he left it, is incredibly complex and amazingly filled with wild, adventurous things. I mean, a lot of his life was almost Dickensian in terms of how it panned out and how it worked and the schools he went to and things like that. So there is so much material that to make one, you know, 120-minute movie is going to be exceptionally difficult to do. And I think it's a huge task that these guys have manfully taken on, and I wish them every success with it. And, of course, I'll help in any way I can to do everything I can to make it as good as it can possibly be. But it is an enormous task, and it's going to take an awful lot of work to sort out just what, basically, what it comes down to, I suppose, is what to leave out. Because Jack led such a rich life for so long that it's just very, very difficult to sort of pull out the high points and weld them all together in a sort of story arc that works. But, I wish them every success with it, and I'm quite looking forward to seeing what happens next.
And that's the nature of film, and certain things that are changed. And some things that are changed are merely perception, and some are real and concrete changes. And there's a question from Heather Lawson. She says, just curious, although C.S. Lewis's ultimate message was conveyed in the movie, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, I'd like to know why certain sequences Lewis had laid out in the book were changed. I'm a teacher who is reading The Magician's Nephew with my class. Any message from Gresham to young readers?
Well, first, to start with the first part of the question first, there are certain things that filmmakers, the people who make movies, the sort of screenwriters and the directors and so forth, think they know a great deal more about than I do, and they probably do in many cases. But there are things about Narnia that I think I know a great deal more about than they do, and probably do in many cases. So at times, there was a sort of a head-to-head kind of discussion process that went through, and I fought for the things I thought were really essential, tooth and nail, right down to the last wire, as it were, including the dialogue at the ending of the movie. But there were quite a few things that I felt were battles, probably best left alone. They just weren't important enough to fight for as hard as I could fight for other things. I had to, in some ways, reserve my energies, I suppose, to argue my point on other matters. So, you know, the whole thing is a compromise situation when you're making a film. You have to compromise so that everybody gets as much of what they want in the movie, everyone has a right to comment, as possible. So there were some scenes that were changed, and the movie makers were convinced that they were changed for the better. And sometimes we agree with that, and sometimes we viewers agree with that, and sometimes we don't, and so forth. And I'm sure that quite a few people in our audience here today would disagree with some of the decisions that I made and tried to push forward. So it's, you know, it's all a compromise situation, and that's how we work it out. We never got sort of cross with each other or bitter or angry or anything. It's just it's a sort of discussion process, and we come up with an answer to every particular problem we come across, and that's what goes in the movie in the end. Whether one's entirely satisfied or not at the end is entirely a different matter. But I will say this, that a lot of people have told me that The Voyage of the Dawn Treader is their favorite of the three Narnian movies. And I think that speaks for itself quite strongly. I also think that the message that Jack wrote into the books, most of it, is there quite strongly, if not even more strongly in some places than it is in the book, in the movie. So I think that all in all, we did a pretty good job with it. But then I'm biased, as I say. Second part of the question reminded me, which was, advice to children about the Narnian Chronicles of the Magician's Nephew. Well, to start with, I think my advice to children is to read. And by that, I mean not just Narnia, not just C.S. Lewis, but all of the great classic writers of the 19th and earlier centuries, and perhaps some of the 20th too, in C.S. Lewis, for example. But I think that if you read, even as you get older, you can read things by writers like John Galsworthy and so forth, because they teach you so much about how the world has come to be what it is today and how to use the English language properly and things like that, which is volumes and volumes of wisdom you will find on the world's library shelves. And you will only find the wisdom of mankind within the pages of books. You won't find it anywhere else.
Well said.
Very well said. And speaking of books, you have actually written Lenten Lands, My Childhood with Joy Davidman and C.S. Lewis. And the other one is Jack's Life, The Story of C.S. Lewis. Speaking to the last one first, I guess, the thing that struck me about that, and I think it was conveyed extremely well in the book, but I think you made a statement at one time that many people know of Jack the scholar or Jack the writer, but not many speak about him in regards to Jack the person. And that book, Jack's Life, certainly does.
I'm probably the only person left alive who ever lived with Jack and really knew the person. And let me also say that quite a lot of the biographers, speaking of Jack the scholar and Jack the Christian apologist or C.S. Lewis, and so forth, get it wrong anyway. The biographies of Jack vary from the good to the bad and the ugly. I mean, and some of them are very good, some of them are very bad, and some are just plain ugly. But I think the reason I wrote Jack's Life was because I was asked to, and it's basically designed for younger readers, at least younger readers at heart, from the ages of about 9 to 90, as far as I'm concerned. But it was rather amusing to me that some of the reviewers of the book in America said things like, well, I don't really understand Mr. Gresham's style here. It's almost as though he were writing for children, well, duh, you know, I was writing for children. But it's been quite remarkable to me, the success that those books have had. Lent and Lambs in particular, I think we published it, oh, look, I can't even remember it so long ago, 20 years ago or something. And the thing is still in print. And it was translated into Spanish and also into Chinese, which made for some rather embarrassing emails because I received a couple of emails in Chinese and I hadn't the faintest idea whether they were fans or horror-stricken people, but because I couldn't understand a word of it. But then the same thing has happened in Spanish. I could get translators in Spanish at the time in Ireland, but I couldn't find anybody to translate the Chinese one, so I had to write back in English with an apology. But, I mean, the fact that those books have been in print as long as they have and still are, it never ceases to amaze me.
Well, we have a couple more questions we can squeeze in from the audience. Arwen, do you want to field those?
From Glum Puddle in the chat room to Mr. Gresham, of the remaining Narnia books, which one are you most excited to see on screen?
All of them.
I like
that. No, it's a simple. The answer is simple because it's a fairly simple question. I'm not more excited about making each individual movie than I was about the last one. I will be completely satisfied and quite happy to shuffle off to Buffalo when I have all seven movies out in front of the public and they're all good movies.
I would add in that case, I hope it's a long time before the rest of the movies get completed so we don't have to see you shuffle off to Buffalo.
That doesn't mean I have to shuffle off to Buffalo. You know?
All right.
There's also a question from, pardon me here, Bibby Oboo. And they say right off the bat, sorry for bad English, but I think it's worded perfectly. Do you think that? Well, let me paraphrase. Do you think that C.S. Lewis was done with Narnia stories? Do you think it was completed in his own mind, or do you think
absolutely? But the interesting thing about that is that when he wrote The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe and finished it, he thought he was finished.
Oh,
he thought that was the end. And then all of a sudden, Prince Caspian leapt into his mind, so he's, oh, I better put that down on paper. So he wrote that one, thinking he'd finished. And then, of course, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader showed up in his head, and he wrote that one, thinking that he'd finished. He never intended to write a series, and he was quite surprised when, finally, at the end of six books were gone, the last battle leapt into his mind, and he had to write that down, and then he knew he was finished. But he had thought he was finished with each book that he wrote. He never intended it to be seven books.
I think that's interesting because I recall reading in some of Tolkien's letters, you know, that he felt the stories were kind of writing themselves as well.
I think if you're writing what the Holy Spirit wants you to write, it's inevitable. I always had the feeling that while Jack wrote the stories down, the Holy Spirit of God was in fact the real author of them.
I'm going to have to agree with that.
I'm glad.
On that note, Arwen has one last question there. Arwen, that very top question, why don't you go ahead and ask that?
I read somewhere that you and your wife became Christians while living in West Australia. Is that correct?
First of all, it wasn't Western Australia. It was, in fact, in Tasmania that my wife committed her life to Christ and became a Christian. But it depends how you define becoming a Christian. I had been a Christian from as early as I can remember. I had believed in God, believed in Jesus. I had a very close encounter personally with Jesus in a churchyard in 1960. I beg your pardon, in 1956. And then again in 1960. But none of those things persuaded me to hand my life over to the authority of Christ, even though I knew who he was and knew what he was capable of. Because if you look back, there's pretty good empirical evidence for the fact that, well, here's a little boy whose parents split up when he's 8 years old. He's taken across the sea to a foreign country called England, where people were decidedly weird, particularly in the 1950s. You know, they drank, they ate weird food, they dressed in weird clothes, and they spoke weirdly, and they did all this sort of stuff and drank weird beer, you know, which was warm. I mean, all this sort of thing. Even to an eight-year-old boy, this was kind of strange. And then I went to a British boarding school and had my American accent very swiftly beaten out of me by the bullies of that school and so on. And, of course, then when I'm 10 years old, my mother was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And it took her 4 years to die, and I had to watch that happening. During that time, I was about as alone for a long time as it's possible to be. Then, of course, I got to know Jack pretty well, and things changed and got better. But then, of course, my mother died when I was 14. And the year after that, my father, who had visited in late 60, and I had become friends with him again, my father in America committed suicide. And the year after that, my stepfather died. So a year and a half after that, my stepfather died. So whoever was running my life, as far as I was concerned, had made a pretty bad job of it. So there was no way I was going to hand my life's, the running of my life over to anyone who was going to continue that kind of performance of management. So it took me quite a long time to realize that I was actually attributing to God things the devil had done, which is a mistake most of us make most of our lives, I think. I've heard mothers in grief shouting, why did God take my baby? And of course, the answer is he didn't. That's the devil's work, and one of his chief ploys is to try to con us into believing that God has done what the devil himself has in fact done. So, I mean, really, it wasn't until much later that I suddenly realized that I was blaming God for the devil's work, and the devil was laughing all the way down the halls of hell because of that, and committed my life to Christ and to his service. I realized that I was not qualified to run a human life, least of all one as complex as my own. And so I gave it to the one who is qualified to run it, and that's Jesus himself.
What a wonderful way to wrap up. That was beautiful.
Thank you.
You know, what a truly amazing inspirational time that we've spent.
Well, let me just finish with something I need to tell you.
Please.
Which is important. It's really important. And I usually open all of my lectures and addresses with this. Any wisdom, you have to remember this, any wisdom you hear from my lips comes to you from the Holy Spirit of God. The folly, on the other hand, is entirely my own, and may he grant you the discernment to tell the one from the other.
Amen.
I'm so glad that I've got grace.
Amen to that.
Yes.
Aren't we all? Michael, we have to wrap it up. I hate to. This has been just an incredible conversation with an incredible individual and individuals and in the chat room, too.
I feel there's a lot more to be said. And yeah. What I'm hoping is that Mr. Gresham had an enjoyable enough time that he could agree to come back with us sometime in the future. I know that's presumptuous for me to say here on live radio, but we'll find out. We'll find out in the future.
No, I'd be happy to do that. Just give me plenty of notice and we'll organize another visit sometime. I enjoyed myself.
Great. That's what we wanted to hear. And,
you know, we never did have Douglas Gresham back on, but that sure gives me an idea. Would you like to hear Mr. Gresham on another special episode of the Secret Fire podcast? Let us know. We'll give you all the ways to contact us in just a moment. We hope that you enjoyed this conversation and that it inspired you to revisit the plethora of amazing writings by C.S. Lewis, and that you'll explore the books that Mr. Gresham has authored, like Lentenlands, My Childhood with Joy Davidman and C.S. Lewis, and Jack's Life, The Life Story of C.S. Lewis. We'll add links to those in the blog post for this episode of the Secret Fire podcast. Stay tuned next week, Iluvatar Willing and the Bruinen Don't Rise, for part 8 of our exploration of the Council of Elrond. The Secret Fire podcast is live each Saturday, Lord willing, at about 2:30 p.m. Eastern Time in the GCT Network studio. Join us for live video on our Twitch page at twitch.tv/secretfirepodcast. You can help the Secret Fire podcast as we read through The Lord of the Rings by becoming a patron of the GCT Network on our Patreon page at patreon.com/GCTN. Any help will provide Lembas bread for the long, arduous journey. Send all email to secretfire@gctnetwork.com. You can follow us on Twitter by searching at Secret Firecast. Subscribe to the podcast by searching your podcast app for Secret Fire Podcast. Our theme song, Hobbit's Dance, is from the album Memories of Middle-earth by Brobdignagian Bards. Find out more about them and buy all the music on their website at thebards.net. And until next time,
I regret to announce this is the end. I'm going now. I bid you all a very fond farewell.
You are tuned in to the GCT Network.
This is your Great Commission. This is your Great Commission transmission
at gctnetwork.com.